Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events here in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, one of your hosts for today, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula, it's good to be back with you again on this broadcast.
It's good to be with you too, Mr. Hart. We have a great show today, Dennis, but as usual, let's first do the news.
As always, we have news from the pages of the Ames Tribune from the past week, and we start with Saturday's edition, which reported that authorities were continuing to interview witnesses after Iowa State University police and Ames police responded to reports of armed suspects near campus on Thursday night. One person was taken into custody along with four BB guns. Saturday's paper also reported that the Saving Our Avian Resources Facility planned to celebrate its fall release party this past Sunday by releasing seven rehabilitated raptors into the wild. Since the beginning of the year, SOAR has taken in about 300 injured or orphaned birds. Last year, the group released 164 birds back into the wild. Saturday's Tribune also had word that a 15-year-old sophomore from Ames High School had won the Bill Riley Talent Search at this year's Iowa State Fair. Anna Yam won with a classical piano performance, and she came away with an $8,000 prize. She said she wants to use that money to pay for music camps that she and her family would not have been able to afford on their own. Anna plans to have a professional music career, and what makes her story even more impressive is that she did not start playing the piano until she was 9 years old. Congratulations, Anna. Sunday's Tribune reported that Heartland Senior Services in Ames has received a $1 million pledge toward its part of construction costs for the proposed Healthy Life Center. Ames residents George and Jan Barron made that $1 million contribution to support Heartland's tenancy in the center. The Healthy Life Center is a joint project between the City of Ames, Mary Greeley Medical Center, Iowa State University, Story County, the Des Moines Area Community College, and Heartland. Total construction cost is estimated at nearly $49 million. That money would be raised by private pledges, contributions from the joint organizations, and by a $15 million bond issue from the City of Ames, which would need 60% voter approval to pass. Also Sunday, the Trib had word that the Story County Genealogical Society was celebrating its 50th anniversary on Sunday at the Ames Public Library. The society was formed to create awareness and interest about genealogy and to help those who are interested in learning about their ancestors. And Sunday's Trib reported that the Royal Pony Farm near Roland is selling off its herd 74 years after the Richardson family bought its first Shetland pony. The family says it's the end of the line, shutting down the operation, and the herd is being sold off. If you're interested, about 50 ponies remain, ranging in age from 6 months to 26 years old, and they're available in a wide variety of colors and patterns, or so they say. The Tribune is not published on Mondays. Tuesday's edition had word that a longtime member of the Ames Fire Department, soon going to become the department's new chief. Rich Higgins will assume his new duties September 1st. He has served as interim chief for several months, and he was one of two finalists for the position. Higgins became an Ames firefighter back in 2002, after working in the city's public works department for 2 years. He was promoted to lieutenant and served as shift commander from 2009 to 2012, when he was promoted to deputy chief. Higgins said in his words, "I'm honored to be selected, and I'm looking forward to implementing new outreach programs and get firefighters into the community." Ames City Manager Steve Shanker, who chose Higgins to be the next chief, praised him and said he had all the skills needed to be successful. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that the Ames School Board resolved questions about its open enrollment policy during its meeting Monday night. The board heard from Superintendent Jenny Reisner, who said the district should work on an individual basis for now to decide open enrollment issues involving students. Also Tuesday, the Trib reported that the City of Ames planned to host two open houses to get public input on planned improvements to Welch Avenue in Campustown, from Lincoln Way to Chamberlain Avenue. Reconstruction of Welch is planned in the next year, involving water and sanitary sewer upgrades. The first open house took place last night. The second one's going to take place next Thursday, September 6th, at the Ames Library at 4:30 p.m. Residents are invited to look at the proposed design ideas for Welch, and city staff members will be on hand to answer any questions you might have. Wednesday's Tribune reported that the Ames City Council wasted absolutely no time Tuesday night breezing through three readings of a revised rental cap hardship exception, and that had the effect of passing those exceptions into law. The exceptions are designed to let some property owners in seven neighborhoods near Iowa State University, where a 25% cap on rentals is in effect, keep their legal status as a rental under some circumstances. Wednesday's Tribune also reported that Story County supervisors approved a budget amendment on Tuesday, letting the supervisors start spending $430,000 in grants for improvements to the Carroll Prairie Reserve north of Nevada and the Jordan Family Wildlife Area southeast of Ames. The board had bought those two parcels of land from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation 2 weeks ago. The supervisors also received money, nearly $450,000, from its insurance provider after the Story County Justice Center was battered by a hailstorm last month. That amount is reimbursement for previous repairs. One more note from Tuesday's supervisors meeting. They approved $5,000 for the county recorder's office to finish a project to scan and digitize historical record books for easier searching, public access, and preservation in case of a disaster. There was more in Wednesday's trip, including word that two people were taken to a hospital with minor injuries after a crash Tuesday on Interstate 35 just south of Highway 30 near Ames. Authorities said heavy traffic in the area had slowed drivers down when the driver of one vehicle failed to slow in time, rear-ending another car. And, of course, that backed up traffic on northbound I-35 for miles. Wednesday's paper also reported that the Democratic candidate for Iowa's agriculture secretary has called on the state legislature to add $5 million to Iowa State University's ag research budget over the next few years. Tim Gannon told the Tribune that his goal is to get the state to spend around $35 million a year for ISU's Agriculture and Home Economics Experiment Station. Currently, the station receives about $30 million a year. Gannon faces Republican incumbent Ag Secretary Mike Naig in this November's general election. And Wednesday's Trib also had word that an Iowa State University football player was charged with harassment after that incident we told you about a few minutes earlier involving BB guns on campus. 18-year-old Dallas Taylor Cortez was suspended from the team along with three other freshmen for what was called a pattern of poor choices and behavior. The investigation into the BB gun incident is ongoing, and authorities said charges could be filed against other people. And Wednesday's paper had word that volunteers are needed to help keep the historic Story County Carousel running through the end of September. Thursday's Tribune reported on U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue's visit to the Farm Progress Show in Boone on Wednesday. Perdue said the Department of Agriculture may consider a second aid package for American farmers if commodity prices do not improve. He said that second round may depend on the outcome of World Trade Organization complaints between the U.S. and other trading partners over the series of competing tariffs put into place over the summer. Perdue's comments came days after the USDA announced details of its $12 billion farmer aid package to cover some of the losses farmers have suffered because of the tariffs. Since those tariffs were announced, corn prices have dropped from about $3.70 a bushel to $3.57. Soybean prices were about $10 a bushel in April. They've dropped to around $8.47 a bushel. Also at that farm show, Iowa 4th District Congressman Steve King made news by defending his previous calls for stricter immigration enforcement, calls he made after the death of University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. King said violent crimes are carried out by undocumented immigrants every day. Authorities said the man charged with Tibbetts' death, Christian Rivera, is an undocumented immigrant. King said it was his responsibility to protect all Americans and that he plans to continue raising the issue while Tibbetts' death is in the national news cycle. He said if his views on immigration were law, Tibbetts would not have been killed. At least one study from the Pew Research Center shows that immigrants commit fewer crimes in the United States than native-born Americans. Thursday's Trib also reported that a dog named Harley will no longer be able to live in Nevada unless his owners meet certain stipulations in the Nevada City Code regarding vicious animals. This past week, the Nevada City Council upheld a notice sent to Roger Lunsford and Peggy Faulkner, a notice that declared their dog, Harley, was a vicious animal. This after several incidents in which Harley allegedly charged at or attacked people, and in one case, another dog. Now, in order to keep Harley in Nevada, his owners must meet certain confinement, leash and muzzle rules, as well as rules regarding enclosure, signs on their property, and insurance. The city will require proof that the dog's owners have not less than $500,000 per occurrence coverage for bodily injury to or death of any person or persons, or for damage to property which may result from the ownership of Harley the dog. And one more note from Thursday's Trib, word that a Story City woman won first place at the Celebration of Iowa Agriculture Art Exhibit this week. Naomi Friend of Story City won with a piece of art called Red Angus Cows. By winning, Friend will receive a cash prize and have her art displayed at the State Historical Building in Des Moines through the end of October. In today's Trib, Fridays, an update on road construction projects and aims that could affect drivers heading to Jack Trice Stadium for tomorrow's home football game opener. So listen closely. South Duff Avenue will reopen today between Jewel Drive and Ken Merrill Road. It's been closed for several weeks as crews expanded to three lanes. But even though it's going to be open, there could still be delays because of ongoing work. The work is not done. The road is just being opened. And there's word that 13th Street, a major east-west route through Ames, will still be closed this weekend between Ridgewood and Harding because of ongoing construction. Speaking of that football game, Iowa State University is going to start using a so-called clear bag policy tomorrow for those attending the game. That means fans wanting to bring items into the stadium, you're going to have a clear bag so that security personnel can see what's inside. Or you're going to have your bag searched, or you can empty the contents of your bag into a Ziploc container that will be provided by the athletic department. That's a change, and that's also going to apply to basketball games this coming year. And that, Ursula, is our summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. A reminder that I'll be back here Monday with a look at what happened in Iowa this past week. And yes, a lot happened in Iowa. So a lot of news going on around these parts.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg here with Mr. Dennis Hart, and thank you again for the news, Mr. Hart. September 8th, there will be demonstrations organized globally about the issue of climate. Around the world, people will be taking to the streets and hold workshops and public forums to show their concern and to look for answers to climate change. Various organizations are planning. The day is being called Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice. Here in Ames, there is a meeting being held on climate solutions, and Mr. Irv Kloss and Ms. Mary Richards are here to tell us about it. Thank you for coming on to Local Talk.
Thanks, Ursula.
Irv, could you please read very briefly what the pamphlet for this event says to give us an idea of the issue?
Well, the dangers of climate change, environmental racism, ecological destruction are looming over all of us. From wildfires to severe storms to drought to flash flooding to toxic pollution to sea level rise, we face more lethal risks every day. And today, we're almost out of time. Every year, as business as usual guarantees more climate catastrophe, more wars, displacement, flooding, and famine, this will bring unimaginable suffering to Iowans, the United States, and people all over the world. We can't hide from the truth any longer. Global warming threatens to destroy our cities, our state, and most life on Earth. We believe climate change, or global warming, if you will, is a moral, ethical, and social justice matter. Our federal government has abandoned its responsibility to protect people and the planet from this coming crisis. Therefore, it falls to we the people working through our local governments to get the job done.
Thank you. Mary, welcome to the show as well. You usually are here in another capacity as producer of the Community Bookshelf, but today you're here working on this particular workshop with Mr. Kloss. Is that correct?
That's correct. I have been a member of the group that he began at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship since he began it, I think, a couple of years ago, our Climate Solutions Circle.
Climate Solutions Circle. And this is a discussion group?
No, it was really formed to be an action group to determine what we could do in the local community. There are many organizations, which we will talk about probably, on a state and particularly national level that are concerned about what can be done. But we were talking about what can individuals do and what can people do in their own communities, in this community.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned there are national organizations. The Rise for Climate Day of Action on September 8th is being organized by a number of national organizations. One of them is working with you, Irv.
Yes.
We actually have somebody on the phone who is from that organization from New York. Irv, could you introduce our guest?
Yes. Well, this is Nicole, who is with Climate Mobilization, a national organization that is stressing the action be taken at the local level, that is, with city governments and or even counties, and then to build that to cities all over the country to try to bring about some changes in policy. Nicole is one of the organizers in New York City.
Hi, Nicole.
Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. You're in New York City, is that right?
I am, actually. But this morning I'm going to be driving across country to get to the Rise March in the Bay Area, and I'll actually be moving out there. So I'll be dipping into Iowa so I can wave from the car.
Cross Highway 80, right?
Yep.
Well, that's quite a road trip.
Yes.
For this morning, welcome to Iowa.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what is happening across the country.
People are waking up. That's what it's coming down to. The Rise March is a reflection of the fact that people are waking up. The work that Irv and Mary are working on in Iowa are just a reflection of people waking up. The climate mobilization was built on the premise that once we really take in the truth of the climate crisis, and Irv reflected that beautifully in his opening remarks, the lethal risks that we face, when we really take that in, we can only act. We are moved to action. Margaret Klein-Solomon, our founder, was a clinical psychologist, and she recognized this and decided to create an organization that was centered on creating a World War II scale mobilization to restore a safe climate. The climate mobilization, we've got 10 affiliated groups across the country, from Philadelphia, from Duluth, Minnesota, of course, Ames, of course, to Tampa, Florida, and even on up to Quebec and Ontario. There are people who are organizing with the climate mobilization to get this concept out into the world, to get the concept of mobilization. And Irv said it exactly right. We're starting in the cities. We're working with people where the job can get done. And then building out to other cities across the country. And then another key concept is building up. So building up to the state levels and then eventually to the federal government. We know that we need a national mobilization in order to get the job done. And so we need all levels of government, all people working towards this, just as we did in World War II, just as the entire country pivoted after Pearl Harbor. Car makers were producing consumer cars, and then they pivoted to making tanks and other war materials. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a full-scale, whole-of-society transformation that begins at the local level, and the work that Irv and Mary are doing is absolutely central to that.
The day of September 8th, the Rise for Climate Day, that has a local focus, right? The idea of that day is to begin locally.
Right. It's on the eve of the Global Climate Action Summit in the Bay Area, which is in part why I'm heading out there. The Global Climate Action Summit is a chance to highlight local action being done currently to inspire further action. We all know that the Paris Agreement would be insufficient. The Global Climate Action Summit is meant to highlight what's happening locally, and really it's frontline communities leading the way, saying that enough is enough. We're not waiting around anymore for higher levels of government to get their act together. We're doing it now.
Nicole, what's your final words to the folks out here in Central Iowa?
I'm hopeful that you can come out and see Irv's and Mary's presentation and then begin to work on your own climate mobilization work. We're getting to local governments, as I said, and then moving on up to state and federal governments to declare the climate emergency, to commit to emergency mobilization, and to then begin advocating that other governments do the same, and that that all peoples, really, that all institutions do the same. That's what I'm hopeful that all Iowans will come out and support that.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for joining us a few minutes, and have a safe and fun road trip.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And if you have time, stop by in Ames and visit us in person.
I'd love to.
It's just about 30 minutes off of I-80, so
hey,
come on by.
I could do that, yes.
Okie doke.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you, Irv and Mary, for all of your wonderful work.
Bye-bye. Irv, tell us what is going to be happening here in Ames.
Well, we have a schedule of speakers, a couple of speakers that are going to briefly talk about some other organizations and action. For example, the director, state director of Interfaith Power and Light, which is a climate organization that's been in existence for more than 10 years. Again, it's a national organization, but there's a state director. That is Matt Russell. And Matt will be helping us with the workshop, and we'll talk about some of the things that Interfaith Power and Light is doing. They're working with faith organizations in order to raise awareness and also to do action-oriented projects. That's one. And then also going to be talking about intergenerational justice. There is a movement among young people today. They will be affected mostly because climate changes. Their future will be hampered by what we do today. There is a young people's group that has filed lawsuit against the federal government, which actually started in 2015. That has gone through the courts now for several years and finally will come to trial in October. They're saying that the government has not done enough to control climate that is in danger of simply running away, and they will not be able to do anything about it in their lifetime. When my grandchildren are my age, and I'm 83 now, they will be faced with catastrophes if we continue to do business as usual.
So the younger generation is important in this.
Absolutely.
You said you felt climate change wasn't really the perfect definition for what we're talking about here.
Not just me, but many people that are in the climate action area, such as Bill McKibben, for example, has stated that we've been using the words global warming, climate change, and those are okay, but it's really climate crisis. We are in a crisis that has to be addressed as a crisis. And so what Climate Mobilization has been doing, and I'm very impressed with their approach to this at the local level, and that is to declare a state of emergency, just like we did in World War II, and mobilize people to start taking action in every way they possibly can. And this will take lots of innovation, thinking about how to do this. In other words, how do you become 100% renewable energy in 10 years? And some cities have actually voted to do that. I'm hoping that we can generate that here in Ames and start doing something that is meaningful. You know, we've been changing light bulbs and we've been converting our power plant from coal to gas, and all those are good steps in the right direction. Building a solar facility, for example, is a step in towards renewable energy. I was doing a lot in wind energy, and we now have up to 40% of our energy comes from wind. But we need to go 100%. How do we do that? We've also got to reduce our emissions from automobiles and other coal-burning, fossil fuel-burning activities that we do. And that covers almost every sector of our economy.
So you're looking for really substantial changes that...
Absolutely.
I think that what is needed has been likened to the mobilization that this country was able to do and happily did and successfully did in the buildup to World War II. That it's that serious
the danger
a
is that
danger.
Great.
That's mm-hmm. right. And that's what we need to do. Of course, it will mean personal sacrifice, but... As in World War II, we as a country decided that it was worth that kind of effort and that kind of personal sacrifice. As a little follow-up to a couple of things that Irv has said, there are, by one count, 74 cities throughout the United States now that have committed to going to 100% clean energy within a matter of a few years. Also, I would personally like people who are listening to note that the city of Ames has been trying to get enough citizen participation to get our own solar field up and running to replace more of the city's energy source, electricity source. And so everybody could go to SunSmart. Exactly.
SunSmart, yeah, that's mm-hmm. it.
We are getting closer to having enough people buy in to form this solar field. We want everybody to see what they can do to pitch in. I know there are some groups that are in the process. You don't actually
You
buy shares, mm-hmm. right, who are actually buying groups of shares.
I'm speaking with Mary Richards and Irv Kloss, who are two of the organizers of a workshop that will be happening on September 8th on climate. Tell us, Mary, why you personally are investing your time and energy in this.
I read a somewhat polemic statement not very long ago in which a person said people who deny the climate crisis and continue to push fossil fuel use must hate their grandchildren. And I'm Irv's age, so we're not going to see the results of this, but our grandchildren certainly will, and I am very concerned about that. I've got to tell you, Irv is a dynamo in terms of energy and ideas and being committed to this concept. And he's the one who has right in front of him what our goals are. So, Irv, take it away.
Well, our goals on September 8th are to first raise the awareness within the community, not only the churches and faith based organizations, but also anyone else that wants to come to the workshop is welcome. And we want to hopefully come out of that with a plan of action that we can begin to work with the local governments, either the city or the county, to start this process of forming a climate plan, a climate action plan that will reduce our emissions and also figure out how to pull carbon out of the air, out of the atmosphere, because we already have too much up there, and we got to pull that out. And we can do that through various means that have been worked out, and I think that's what we have to do. As I say, we have to mobilize in a similar way that we did for World War II.
And you're interested in working with individuals and with various levels of government.
Right.
Starting with the local city, county, state.
Right. That's what we hope to do. And once we get ours in place, we can move out and outreach to other cities.
Okay. Well, before we move on, Irv, tell us why you personally care so much about this and anything else you'd like to say. And then don't forget to tell us exactly when and where this is so folks can join us.
Well, I got into this because I first began studying what the science behind climate change and what it meant. And then I said, we have to do something because it's obvious that things are really getting serious. The warning signs were all there. And then, as Mary said, I am concerned about my grandchildren and their children because this is future generations are ones that are going to really be hurt. And we're being hurt now. It's not just in the future, but right now. We're seeing more severe storms and flooding and sea level rise, and even public health is being affected because of new diseases that are moving in from other areas because of the warming that's going on. So that's it. Now, the workshop will be from 1 to 4 in the afternoon on Saturday, September 8th, and it will be at the Unitarian Fellowship at 1015 North Highland Avenue. Everyone is welcome.
Do you have to have a plan to come to the workshop?
No, just interest, yeah.
Okay. September 8th, 1 to 4?
Right.
At the Unitarian Fellowship, which is at
1015 North Highland.
In Ames.
In Ames.
Thank you. Mary, any last words?
I just counted up in the email that I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 organizations that are basically national who are interested in this. Ours is not the only September 8th.
This is happening all over the world.
It's happening all over.
Right. All over the world.
So we are getting help from some of those organizations mm-hmm. as well.
Okay, thank you. And we'll put the information about the meeting on the KHOI website as well in case somebody has heard this and didn't have time to write it down. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Feel no more. far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue.
That was Peter Mayer with Blue Boat Home, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Welcome at 37 minutes after the hour on this Friday. I'm Dennis Hart with Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. We have a new reporter on the Local Talk team. Tammy Kuhn is from Nevada.
Welcome, Tammy.
And she's not here with us now, but she did file a report from the Nevada Rodeo.
The rodeo on August 25th in Nevada, Iowa, was my first rodeo. It was part of the Lincoln Highway days. It was 90 degrees with high humidity as thousands of people packed the risers. There were hundreds of children sitting on the ground in front of the risers behind the steel fence. It was the final event of the year, last chance for the athlete riders to earn points on the pro tour to qualify for the televised finals in a few weeks. So there were lots of people there locally as well, riding with professional riders too. Wright Family Farms is a big rodeo outfit from Iowa that provides all the cattle for roping and the steers that they ride and all of that kind of thing. And I think they do that all around the country too. So I didn't know anything about rodeos when I went there, but I learned that they basically, to me, seem to have two teams, the animals kind of versus the riders. Now, I'm not sure those are professional rodeo terms. Animals kind of earn points, and the riders win money if they complete their event. For example, how long they stay bareback bull riding. Then there's saddleback bull riding, calf roping, bucking broncos. There's team calf roping and barrel chasing. It's all really exciting. It was within these events that the drama of the rodeo kind of played out, which kind of made me, the phrase was going through my mind saying, this is America. We don't run from our bulls. We ride them. And that was kind of a point of patriotic frenzy for me. One of the events, you have to actually rope the calf, bring it to a standstill, get off the horse, turn the calf over. Physically, you have to lift this calf and then tie its legs together, both in the front and the back. And then you have to get back on your horse, and the calf has to stay still. It doesn't hurt the calf. In some cases, that calf got up again, and then you don't get any points, so you don't make any money. You could travel all this way from anywhere, and you go home with nothing if that calf gets up. So it was definitely a little piece of Wild West Americana that came to Nevada, Iowa. It was a very patriotic event because we stood up and recognized veterans. They did a special tribute for them. And there were people from all walks of life there. There were people with Harley Davidson shirts, and farm families were helping run the event right alongside the cattlemen. So it was just an exciting group of people that were gathered together to see a really fun event.
Got the maestro. They won the rodeo on this fool a year ago.
Another great
run. Thank you, Tammy Kuhn. That was exciting, and we are looking forward to working with you. Thanks for joining us.
And if you have just joined us, this is Local Talk, and there are more than one type of strong animals in the world.
Lots of them.
Did you know that there is such a thing as a super generation of muscled monarchs, Dennis?
I didn't know that, and it almost scares me to think about it. Man, you don't want to get in their wings, I'll tell you that. They'll blast you.
They are not broncos, but they do fly to Mexico.
Okay.
Pretty big accomplishment. And
yes.
Here is KHOI's naturalist, Pat Schlarbaum, with monarch expert Stephanie Shepherd from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Pat?
Hey, we're with Stephanie Shepherd.
I used to work with this woman, and I might mention that the Wildlife Diversity Program got the biggest boost I can recall in 33 years when we hired Stephanie Shepherd to oversee the prairies. And she's a butterfly person, and we're going to talk about monarchs today. Welcome to Local Talk, Stephanie Shepherd.
Well, thank you, Pat, and you're way too nice, but it was a pleasure working with you.
So this time of year, bring us up to date. What's going on with monarch butterflies?
Yeah, it's an exciting time of year for monarch butterflies. This is when the butterflies get to a point where they're ready to make their big trek down to Mexico. Once a year, they, probably the fourth or fifth generation of monarchs in Iowa, decides that it's time to go to Mexico, and they produce what's called a super generation. These butterflies are bigger and more muscled and, you know, are sort of designed to make this arduous journey. So they load up on nectar and they start moving south. So
so muscled, it's not a term you would equate with butterflies. Exactly what are you referring to there?
Well, so they do have muscles, like in there, maybe not in the sense that, I guess I'm not sure about the actual biological structure of them, but, you know, their thorax in particular, where their legs and their wings attached to their body is packed with muscles that, you know, allow them to flap their wings and, you know.
Sure. A different kind of muscle than what we would find in mammals, I guess.
I'm sure. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So they're going to be wayward bound, what, 3,000 miles is what they're preparing for this next excursion across North America?
Right. They make one of the most amazing migrations on the planet, because not only are they flying for an insect, a very long distance, not even just for an insect, for anything, it's a pretty long distance, but they're also doing it having not done it for three or four generations. So it's not, you know, it's like you're trying to travel to your great-great-great-grandmother's homestead in Mexico that you've never been to before. So, like, how does that even work? And how do they know where to go? But they have a spot in Mexico that is kind of just the exact right climatic conditions, or that they kind of go into. They can live out the winter without, like, having to do a lot of nectar gathering, and they kind of go into hibernation, if you will, though it's not true hibernation.
A lot of unique structures and anatomical traits and genetic coding here. And it's in that location in Mexico, it seems like a lot of the surveys come up with an estimation of the current population. Where are we at with the population of monarchs, say, trending in the last 5 years?
Right. The trend over the last 5 years it's gone down to its lowest point, as well as climbed a little bit back up. But the count for this last year was a little disappointing. It had gone down again, even though I think ideas of, you know, people seeing monarchs here felt like the population was pretty good. But yes, because the entire population of monarchs from, you know, east of the Rocky Mountains goes to this one set, you know, mountaintop in Mexico, they can basically estimate the number of butterflies based on the amount of hectares of trees they cover. And so they, usually it's reported as the number of hectares. And I think last winter's was somewhere in the 2 to 3 hectare range.
And that's 2.5 acres in a hectare?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
And there's a lot of emphasis on milkweed planting. Do you have a favorite of all the different kinds of milkweeds? What's the one that you like the most to recommend?
Well, it depends on where you are. If you're in an urban setting, I would probably recommend either swamp milkweed, butterfly milkweed, or whorled milkweed. Those three tend to be they're not as aggressive as common milkweed.
And the adult monarchs are seeking them out to lay their eggs.
Right. Yeah. The milkweeds are absolutely essential for the monarchs to lay their eggs and for the caterpillars. That's the only thing that the caterpillars will eat. So, for example, I have a little patch of swamp milkweed in my yard in Urban Boone and the other day, and I had five caterpillars all like huge, fat, ready to transform into adult butterflies that I found within like 20 seconds. So they're really revving up and producing lots of bugs. And those were the first, you know, I just planted those swamp milkweed this year. So they really found them very quickly and started utilizing them. So, you know, even if you're in an urban setting, you can really produce really great habitat for them. And then if you're in a rural setting, common milkweed, I would add that in as well. If you're not worried about, you know, having something that looks a little messy and wild, then common milkweed is great too. They love it.
Yeah, I watch for those in all the roadsides, and they, right. And with the advent of Roundup, it seems like there's just fewer and fewer of those common ones. So you are encouraging people to plant milkweeds. Is there anything else that comes to mind that you can encourage our listeners to do to help the monarchs? As you mentioned, they are gathering this time of year. What's that all about when they gather together?
Well, so the Journey North is the organization. So if you're interested in kind of following the monarch migration, journeynorth.org is a great website to keep an eye on. And they've basically noted that they're starting to see roosts of monarchs. So as the monarchs start to migrate, they, and honestly, I don't think we understand how they choose the particular trees or places where they decide to, you know, all kind of congregate to spend the night, basically. Like, it's kind of a way station that they rest, you know, in between legs of the journey. So there's, I'm sure folks have seen these trees that are just covered with monarch butterflies here during the month of September is kind of the peak of the migration here in Iowa. So one of the things that you can do during this time of year that's really exciting is actually you can tag monarchs. Monarch Watch, monarchwatch.com or org, just Google Monarch Watch, sells tagging kits. And anybody can do this as long as you have a net. That's pretty much all you need is to catch the monarchs as they're moving through, and you put a little sticker basically on their hind wing, and that helps scientists sort of track like where the monarchs that end up in Mexico come from and that kind of thing. So that's kind of, there's a lot of citizen science opportunities to get involved in, as well as creating habitat.
Well, so let's mention you do work with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Is there a site where you can assist with this if people want to take this further?
Well, I know that as far as the tagging, I don't know that the DNR has any specific events for tagging coming up, but almost all the county conservation boards. So check in with your county conservation board, or Story County, I'm sure, has some tagging events.
Any other events?
Yeah, so we also have a fun event coming up in the middle of September hosted by the Blank Park Zoo called Monarch Festival that they do. They've been doing for several years now. There'll be tons of vendors. There'll be Mexican dancing because it's kind of in conjunction with the Latino Festival in Des Moines. And that's an important part of the monarch's journey, is that Mexican portion of the of and how they feel about the monarchs. And then there's will be a bug parade, so lots of little kids dressed up as insects that parade around the zoo. So it's a really fun day, and it will be from 12 to 4 on September 16th at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines.
It is a Sunday.
Yeah.
At the Blank Park Zoo, September 16th, noon to 4.
Yep, and
come
we'll
out.
Definitely be there. We'll be handing out milkweed or getting having seeds for kids to plant.
Sure.
And take home to plant in your yard.
Yeah, that's pretty uplifting. Mm-hmm. And you see how the wildlife focus has shifted from waterfowl, big game, that does include butterflies now. And that's what I was really striving for all these years with the Wildlife Diversity Program. And Stephanie Shepherd, you're a really, really, really key person. And keep up the good work. Is there anything else?
I don't think so, except for to thank everyone. I mean, I think the monarch has been an incredibly rewarding species to work with because people have really stepped up and are doing everything they can to help this critter. And that's really heartening to see when you're someone like me who cares about, you know, wildlife and cares about monarch butterflies, is to see the rally of support that everybody's given. So it's a heartening story.
You're a wildlife champion extraordinaire. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you.
And thank you, Pat and Stephanie Shepherd, for the report on the monarchs.
All of her days have gone soft and cloudy. All of her dreams have gone dry. All of her nights have gone sad and shady. She's getting ready to fly. Fly away. Fly away. Fly away. Life in the city can make you crazy. The sounds of the sand and the sea. Life in a high rise can make you hungry. The things that you can't even see. Fly away. Fly away. In this whole world, there's nobody as lonely as she.
Nobody as lonely as me.
There's nowhere to go, and there's nowhere that she'd rather be. She's looking for lovers and children playing. Looking for signs of the spring.
Where is the spring?
She listens for laughter and sounds of dancing. She listens for any old thing. Fly away. Fly away.
This is Ursula Rudenberg, Local Talk.
And I'm Dennis Hart.
Dennis, you mentioned to me that most butterflies only live for 2 weeks.
That's an amazing story. They live for a couple of weeks. Monarchs are different. They can live much longer, and that's how they can make that migration down to Mexico, down south. But, you know, and I've learned more about butterflies this summer being in Ames because my wife volunteers at Ryman Gardens in the butterfly area. And so she's always taking pictures and inviting me in to see them. And that's just a remarkable sight at Ryman Gardens. There's 1,000 butterflies in there at any one time, and most of them are going to be gone in 2 weeks, and they have to keep replacing.
That's just amazing.
It's heartbreaking, amazing. And yet it's nature. That's the way nature works.
It's nature. And then there's new butterflies.
Yes.
So Dennis, this brings me to we had rodeos, and now we have monarchs. So this brings me to a segment that I want to start on Local Talk.
Yes.
As you know, I've been itching for this for a long time.
Yes.
I decided to call the segment The Wild Ones.
The Wild Ones. Okay.
The
I thought that
ones.
Referred to you and me, but I guess not. Okay.
Well, it does as well. But as if you're listening to the show, you, like us, know that part of living in central Iowa is having wild animals around you all the time. I have never seen more brazen wild animals than I have in Ames, Iowa. I am constantly having encounters with wild animals.
As I am.
So I want to talk about them. I want to hear your wild one story, Dennis. And also, I want to hear the stories of you, the person who's listening to this radio broadcast. So our email address is khoiradio@gmail.com. Real simple, khoiradio@gmail.com. If you have a story about an encounter with wildlife, write it in and we'll read it on the air. Because this stuff happens all the time. So we don't have much time, but I want to tell you about me and the deer and Tai Chi.
Okay.
I do Tai Chi. It's good for my back.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it on the back patio of my dad's house. I'm living with my dad right now up on Ross Road. And he's got a nice patio in the back. Mm-hmm. And those of you who live in that area know that the whole Ross Road area is kind of the beginning of this huge green space that goes all the way through, you know, Emma McCarthy Lee and Mon Woods. So there's a lot of wild animals there. So there's a lot of deer there. And they sleep in our backyard. And in the morning when I do Tai Chi, they stand up and they watch me.
Wow.
And they kind of like tilt their heads to the side. Because they can tell that I'm doing something very intentional. And I guess they can tell that it's non-threatening because they don't run away. But they really can't figure out what I'm doing. And I guess, you know, animals watch body language.
Mm-hmm.
That's their language, right? And so they're definitely getting that there's some sort of body language going on here, but they cannot figure out what it is. So they stand around and watch me. And they kind of tilt their heads from side to side. And I think that's kind of an indication that they're thinking. I got kind of tired of them watching me, actually.
Really?
Yeah. And so I went inside and I was doing Tai Chi inside. And then I look up and there's a deer watching me through the window.
Wow. Wow. That is neat.
So that's my wild one story.
And you're going to have more on Monday. We're going to do this.
I have so many more. Speaking of deer, I have one more.
Yes.
My dad was driving home the other night from the university, and he encountered a deer who was nursing her two babies in the middle of Highland Avenue.
Wow. Very cool. I have a very quick story, my wild animal story. We have a deck with a crabapple tree that comes right up alongside it. Every morning, a squirrel gets up that crabapple tree, and it's right over our deck. And he gets on a branch there, and sometimes he'll get down right on the deck and watch us as we're eating breakfast. The squirrel will do that.
He wants your food.
He wants the food. He probably knows we're on Local Talk and wants to be on the air. I don't know.
Or maybe he just likes you and your wife.
But he always watches us, and that's so cute.
It's so cute. And it's true that wild animals are curious about us people, especially because they live.
And you and I will have more animal stories Monday when we do this broadcast.
The wild ones.
We'll be there on Monday. And until then, you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been your hosts. I'm Dennis Hart, and you are?
Ursula Rudenberg, and Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and on Friday.
5 o'clock.
It airs at 5 o'clock.
This
we've
afternoon.
Changed it to 5 o'clock.
That's right.
So it's 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. here on KHOI, 89.1 FM, and also remember that you can hear us online, streaming live at khoifm.org. And you can also listen to an archive of the show on the homepage with links to the organizations and events we talked about.
Local Talk was engineered today by the brilliant Aladdin. Thank you, Aladdin.
Thank you, Aladdin.
Our theme song, as always, Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their great CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley, who was a great lady herself.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Special shout out to Tammy Kuhn for taking the plunge and joining the team. We're looking forward to working with you, Tammy.
Indeed we do. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. And squirrels will, too.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.